This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, with you for the next hour on the show trainers listen to, and that is the case. So many of you had told me you've enjoyed this program. You are listening throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and you're streaming us live or podcasting us on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Many of you may not be familiar with today's guest, at least not yet. She has saddled just one horse here in the United States, which, by the way, resulted in one win. That is the way to begin a training career. Her extensive background in racing has taken her around the world, working with some of the biggest international names in the sport. She's also enjoyed success as a consigner, and after seeing what she can do when she leads one over in the afternoon, the sky is the limit for my special guest here today. Please join me in welcoming trainer Michelle Hemingway to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Michelle, appreciate the visit.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Yeah, excited to hear your story. I mentioned the international side of it. We'll talk about that. But first and foremost, let's start with looking back to last weekend at Gulfstream Park. And I mentioned your first U.S. horse that you have saddled here in the States. It results in a win. What a way to start.
Yeah, it was really exciting. I don't think, for as many different horses as I've had the pleasure to be involved with, I don't think there was anything quite as special as that.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because you have saddled grade one winners, but this was not a grade one. It was not a grade in stakes, and it meant so much to you, which a lot of people would say, boy, there's no way that can mean as much as the grade one winners.
No, it really did. I'll be honest with you. I really have to thank Nick Saluso for the opportunity with this horse and his faith in me. And I think it was just, it just felt so different because he was a project, everything. He kind of became, he kind of became my boyfriend, right? My boyfriend joked, hey, you treat him better than me. So I think it sort of became that sort of thing. So I think it was just that much more special. I mean, the grade one winners in my past, they've been wonderful, but there's really nothing like this with this horse.
You said afterwards, when you were standing in the winner's circle, you said, I'm crying like a little girl. That is what this sport is all about, right? That emotion and that emotional connection with the horse, it just means so much.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, this horse was really special to me, and it was just everything coming together, and I was so overcome by emotion, it came out my eyeballs. That happens to me a lot, but it definitely came out my eyeballs in that situation.
Yeah, we're talking about, of course, Manor House, who was the winner this past week at Gulfstream for Michelle, a very special moment. You mentioned Nick Saluso. Tell me a little bit about that relationship there.
Nick has just been incredible. I have known Nick really for most of my life, with his father being a trainer and our backgrounds coming together. I've known him most of my life, and I've always really wanted to have the opportunity to sort of work with him because I think he's quite a talented horseman. And, we came together, I'm going on about 2 months ago now, and he offered me a position, and I took it. And it's turned out to be the best decision I've ever made.
Manor House was coming off of a long layoff, too. Did you spend a lot of time working with Manor House to get him ready for the race?
Yeah, I mean, I think we spent 271 days all together, and then, quite a special training program, and there's a whole team of us here at Thoroughstock. It's definitely, you know, it's a team effort. Without every member of this team, the horse wouldn't have done what he did. So I'm just so appreciative of every single member. Nick Saluso, Jimmy Randolph, our foreman Luis, our farriers. I'm just so pleased that everyone was able to come together and put this horse back together to make him what I know he can really be.
That's an interesting statement, Michelle, because, you know, so many times a trainer will refer to the horses as they'll either refer to themselves as a coach and they're coaching the players, or they'll say, okay, I'm like a proud parent and that the horses are like my kids. It sounds like you're kind of on both sides of that fence, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, let's be honest. Without the horses, what are we? I mean, we make the horse, but the horse makes us. Because without the horse and being part of a game, we've got nothing. So, I mean, he's definitely the biggest member of the team, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Where does he go from here after that big win?
You know, I think we're not really decided yet. He's back here with us at our training center in Ocala, and we're going to take it, you know, step by step and see where he goes. And we have high hopes for him, so we'll just get him on a path to get him exactly where he needs to be.
After spending so much time to get him back to the races, now that he's won and you've accomplished that, do you take a step back and say, okay, let's give him a little time, or do you let the horse dictate what he wants to do? How does that work from here, Michelle?
We'll definitely let the horse dictate to us. You know, we've got him back here. We've got him relaxing. We've got him happy. He gets, you know, his Beamer blanket every day. He comes in and gets his morning hug from me. And he really is a hugger. I walk in his stall every morning and I pet his head and he wraps his whole neck around me and gives me a hug. He's really a hugger. He's a sweet horse. So he gets that every morning. And, you know, we'll get him back on the track in the next day or so and sort of let him tell us what he wants to do.
What things do you look for as the trainer that tell you, okay, he's ready to take the next step and keep going forward?
You know, obviously you're always watching their coat, the way they move, the look in their eye, how they take to their training. If they're a little tired on the track, you're obviously going to take that into account. If they're above themselves, you're going to take that into account at the same time. I think so many trainers feel like, okay, the horse is above himself, he's really ready to go, when really it might be the opposite. He's so above himself that he's going to not run to his ability. It's honing his energy or her energy into the spot where it's supposed to be so they can get their prime physical activity in that race.
How good do you think Manor House can be?
Well, I can tell you this. He's pretty much as good as most of the horses that have been really good that I had my hands on. I think he's very talented.
How long does it take you to know that when you start working with a horse?
Honestly, it's funny. This horse, the first time I saw him and I looked at him in the stall, I just had a feeling. He has a presence and he has a class about him, and you really get a feeling. And that was before I ever even watched him train on the track. And then as I watched him train on the track, every little thing you asked him to do, he would do, and he would do better. So he was kind of like that student in school that's working to go to Yale, that doesn't do just enough, but goes above and beyond each and every time without being overcooked or overpressured, just does it very easily.
Oh, pretty cool stuff. Talking to Michelle Hemingway here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. You heard us talk about Manor House, who became her first horse that she ever saddled here in the United States, and it became her first winner shortly after that. When you were walking over with Manor House, Michelle, and you walked into the paddock, tell me about that moment. What was that like leading him over?
I'll be honest with you. I think the thing that was the most disappointing is at Gulfstream Park, people make fun of me for this, they give like a best turned out award. So I worked really hard. I wanted him to look beautiful. I had the black bridle and the black and blue brow band. I braided his mane myself. I made him look all pretty. And I was like, okay, I walked past Sharon McGlinchey and I'm like, now you better look at my horse because he looks good, right? And I think I was just trying to think about how he looked in the paddock and how he was acting. And, you know, I was hoping that she was going to notice that. So it was funny. You know, I'm a girl, so we think about those things.
Yeah, I mean, well, you got to look the part, right?
Right.
You know, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. How much different is it leading a horse over that you've worked with for so long, and you're the trainer of record? It's going to be your first starter here in the States, as opposed to, you know, leading a horse over that is trained by somebody else. You're the assistant trainer or whatever the case might be. But now that you're the one in charge and you've had a hand in getting this horse to the races, how much different was that for you making that walk?
To be honest with you, when I was an assistant, I always sort of considered them to be my horses. So I felt the same amount of pressure, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing was, it was all the eyes that were on me and all the questions that I was getting of, oh, wow, why now? How did you get here? What is it about this horse? You know, as opposed to, it wasn't really a thought process of the horse being any different or the result being any different. It was more the questions that were coming from people of, like, why did you decide to do it with this horse? Where did this come from, you know?
Yeah, so why did you decide to do it with this horse?
You know, I think mostly because Nick Saluso offered me the opportunity. If it wasn't for the opportunity that Nick offered me and bringing me to be part of Thoroughstock and this great organization, I think I probably just would have been okay, you know, posting along and being an assistant or doing this or doing that. But, you know, Nick is really supportive of me and my career, and we enjoy looking at horses together. I think we have a really huge respect for one another about the way we handle horses and the way we look at horses. And when I told him, I said, you know, not for nothing, I do have my trainer's license, and he made the decision to support me and get me started.
Tell me more about Thoroughstock and the facilities and the work that you guys do there.
So we are a training facility here in Ocala, Florida. We have what I feel is state-of-the-art facilities. We have a racetrack. We have a 60-stall barn. We have a swimming pool. We have some of the best rehab equipment you could think of, including we do a lot of PEMF therapy. We have Beamer blankets. We have vibrating floors. We have lasers. And we do everything on this farm, from rehabbing to training babies to go to the two-year-old sales to breaking babies for end users and sending to the racetrack, as well as racing management. The whole aspect is, Thoroughstock is part of Saluso Equine Management, and what we're trying to do is develop a brand between the team, between Nick and myself, and some other aspects of the business, that we can be a full-service facility, anything from training to racing management to buying horses at the sales. We want to be able to cover any need that someone in the horse racing industry might have.
Did you say vibrating floors?
Yes, I did.
Are you going to explain that one to me?
So it's called a TheraPlate, and it's a new, I don't think it's that new. It's been in for quite a while, and it's a floor that we literally walk the horses onto, and you can put a setting on it, and you make it, you know, certain different intensities, and the floor vibrates underneath the horse, and it works to promote foot growth, circulation, helps with bone bruising, helps with sore muscles. And we put a lot of these horses, they go on it for 20 to 30 minutes a day, the horses that need it. And Manor House is a big fan of the TheraPlate.
You know, it's interesting because we hear about various types of rehab treatment and recovery treatment with professional athletes on the human side. It's very much the same thing with horses now. Talk about, Michelle, some of the things that we're seeing now. You mentioned the vibrating floor, but there are other things, I'm sure, that we're seeing with horses similar to what we see with human athletes that are helping them recover faster and perform better because they stay healthier longer, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we utilize here that I like a lot is a blanket that's called a Beamer blanket.
Okay.
And you put the Beamer blanket on the horse, and it basically works on the horse through a cellular level, and the waves go towards the area of the horse's body that needs repair. And I guarantee, like, every horse you put on this Beamer, you'll see them when you first put it on them, they might be like, I'm not so sure about this. And then after about 2 minutes of it being on them, you just see their whole body relax, and they just start to really come into themselves, and they start to enjoy, and they look for our lady that comes by every day and puts the Beamer blanket on them and does the therapies with them. We do a lot of MagnaWave therapy, laser therapy. I mean, these are ultimately world-class athletes. They need to be treated just like our human world-class athletes are.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a great point. What's more important? Well, I guess if a horse doesn't have a serious injury that they're rehabbing from and they're either in training on the farm or they're in training at the racetrack, I'm assuming that it's pretty important just to keep them happy so they maintain that level of performance. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah. You want them, if you have a horse that's getting out there and not wanting to do their job, you've got a problem, right? And you have to figure out why they don't want to do it, because ultimately thoroughbreds, they want to compete. They're athletes. They want to run. So if they're telling you they don't want to do it, there's a reason why. So you have to figure out how to get into their head and get them happy. Is it a soreness thing? Are they sour? Whatever the issue is, and get them around so they're wanting to do it for you again.
How about from a nutrition standpoint, Michelle? I know that that's important with human athletes too. It's critical to performing at the highest level. Very much the same thing with horses.
Oh yeah, nutrition is huge. You've got to find the right feed that works. And I know here at Thoroughstock, we have our feed companies and our distributors that we use, but not every horse is on the same nutritional program. Each horse, we evaluate each horse to figure out what is the proper nutritional program that horse needs. What is it that horse is lacking that another horse might have more of? And we balance each horse's diet based on what their nutritional needs are. Because they're just like people, right? Like, I might not be able to eat as many carbs as another person. It's the same thing with horses. And you figure out, okay, this is what their body needs for their coats to look like this, their top line to look like this. And when you get them there, then you know they're getting everything they need because their body shows you. Even though they can't speak to you, their body shows you they've got the right nutritional value.
Yeah, oftentimes with, say, in the sport of football, you'll hear about an offensive lineman that comes in from college and starts playing in the NFL, and they want them to bulk up and put on weight, but the good weight, you know, the muscle weight.
Right.
It might be the opposite, where they want somebody to slim down to play a certain position. Do horses have optimal weights where they perform? And I know it's different for each horse, but do they have optimal weights that you'll find, okay, this is where we want to keep this horse because it fits their frame and they run well at this weight? Is that a thing?
Yeah, it's actually funny that you mentioned that, because I don't see it as much of a thing. How do I say? I see it as a thing for sure here in this country, where you look at them and it's sort of a all done by eye. I like the way their weight is here, more on the top line, less in the belly, more in the belly, less in the top line, however the management is. But actually in South Africa, when I was there, we had to weigh every horse once a week, and we knew what their ideal weight was, and what, when they were too heavy or when they were too light. And actually, when we walk in to the racetrack to run them on the day, as they get off the horse carrier and they pass by the state vet, they have to stand on a scale and they get their weight. And the bettors in South Africa are allowed to see what the horse's weight is. And it shows for each and every race how much they weigh, so they can get an idea for their betting whether they're over or under.
Oh, wow. So it's not just the jockeys that have to do it like they do here in the States, it's the horses too.
Yeah, in the States they use in South Africa they use the horse's weight in a betting sense, absolutely. And I don't see as many on the scales here as I did over there, but here they do it all more off eye. But I think it's definitely a thing with these horses, like, you know, when they're too heavy, when they're too light, where their weight should be distributed versus where it is in that moment, and that's when you know you have them really where they should be.
Do you think that's an effective handicapping angle, Michelle, for people that are trying to pick a winner, to know the horse's weight?
I mean, I don't know. I think over there, I think in South Africa, that they don't, or at least, I mean, I've been back here now, gosh, longer than I'd like to imagine, probably about 13 years I've been back from South Africa. I've gone back and forth a few times, but I've been back training here now for 13 years. And 13 years ago when we were there, they didn't have all the different handicapping tools like we do here. They didn't use buyer speed figures. They didn't use rag numbers and things like that. So I think in that situation, it probably did help the bettors. Over here, I'm not sure if it would make that much of a difference.
Michelle Hemingway, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Michelle, let's go back to the beginning here for a minute. Now, I do want to get to your time in South Africa and talk about some of the people that you had the chance to work with there and some of the horses. But take me back to the beginning. How did Michelle Hemingway first become interested in horses and horse racing?
Actually, I'm third generation horse person. My okay. grandfather, my paternal grandfather, is actually the person that is credited with making show jumping an Olympic sport.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, he was an avid rider, fox hunter, racehorse owner in Canada. My aunt was an avid show jumper. My father was a racehorse trainer. And so I grew up in it. And it was interesting, as I grew up as a kid, I would... In the mornings, I would have to get up, feed the horses, gallop a few, go to school. In the afternoons, I would have to go to my aunt's house, ride the show jumpers, then go home and do homework. And so I kind of did both. I did, you know, galloping in the morning. I did show jumpers in the afternoon. I became a really avid equestrian, showing all over the country and Canada and Mexico. And then I went to Sweetbriar College on a riding scholarship.
Okay.
And studied international equine business and marketing at Sweetbriar, and I had a minor in Spanish and rode all throughout university. And then, you know, the rest is history. Got jobs in the racing industry, but I still ride show jumpers for fun. So I've always been involved.
What led you to study international equine marketing?
It was actually interesting. At Sweetbriar at the time, we didn't have an equestrian major. And Shelby French was the director of the riding school. And she and I talked, and I was thinking about going to vet school, but I always knew I wanted to rather do more of the training side. So Shelby and I sat down and we said, well, let's write a business degree that deals with equine. So we put together animal behavior classes, animal science classes, business classes, and marketing classes. And we created the major for Sweetbriar in 2003. And it's been now a major at Sweetbriar ever since then. I minored in Spanish because all of the women on my father's side of the family, my aunt, my cousin, and myself, were all fluent in Spanish. So it just made sense to do Spanish as a minor, seeing as I work in the horse industry.
Yeah. Are you fluent in Spanish now?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, wonderful. Boy, what a story. What a background that is. So this was all you ever wanted to do, Michelle, right? Just be around
yes.
horses?
Yep, pretty much.
Yeah, that story about your grandfather is fantastic with the Olympics. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So my grandfather was actually, he grew up in Canada. He was born in Alberta, and then he came and he went to the Royal Military College of Canada. And it's a very prestigious school, and he was an avid sportsman. He played football for the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and he was drafted, well, he went into the war, World War II, and he became a general, and... when he got, you know, out of the war, he decided to spend more time with his horses and his riding because he'd always grown up doing it, and became involved with Molson Breweries and ended up buying racehorses and sat on the Olympic committee because he was such a large athlete and had been in Munich and got involved and decided, put a group together, decided that show jumping, put it in front of the Olympic committee. They accepted it, and then he eventually became the chef de cuisine of the Canadian equestrian team.
Wow, what a fascinating life, huh?
Yes, he was an amazing man.
What was his name, Michelle?
His name was Brigadier General William Dennis Whitaker.
Man, so you mentioned the Hamilton Tiger Cats and his time in the CFL. Have you ever had a chance to spend any time with Jim Lawson up at Woodbine?
I have not, no. I have not. I haven't actually been to Woodbine since I was a little kid when I went back, and no, maybe a little older than that. My dad's horse that he trained held the track record at Woodbine, well, still holds it on the original surface, going 3/4 of a mile, and they did like a celebration for him when I was, I think, 17. So that was the last time I was at Woodbine.
Yeah, so Jim Lawson is now the CEO of Woodbine, but he was the chairman of the board of the Canadian Football League for many, many years.
Wow.
And he and I talk about that quite often when he joins me here on the show. He would appreciate that story. I'm sure he's probably familiar with your grandfather's story, but he would appreciate hearing that story if you ever get a chance to meet him. I'm sure you guys would have a lot in common.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah. So is there anything you've taken from the show horse world that you now incorporate when you're working with the thoroughbreds? Are there some similarities?
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, that's one thing that I enjoy talking with Nick about because, you know, he agrees with me that the whole basis of these horses come from their hind end. And a lot of times you see some of these horses go to the racetrack, and they just go as fast as they can turning left, and they're putting all their weight forward on their front end because they don't really know what collection is and how to get a long leg on them and sit up and teach them how to use their hind end. If you don't teach a horse how to use their hind end, they're never going to be able to hold together in front. So Nick has some visions for the future that I think are really going to help at this farm and the way he rides on allowing people to learn to collect the horse and make their hind end go first before their front end instead of just tearing around turning left as quickly as they can.
All right, forgive my ignorance here, Michelle, but doesn't a horse just run the way a horse runs? How do you teach them to run differently and use their hind end?
Well, because naturally, I mean, it's horse to horse. Some horses are more naturally going to be on their hind end. Other horses are going to more naturally be on their front end. It's just like a person. One person might walk with their toes a little more in than the other person. So you have to teach a horse when you're on their back. You have to teach them through your hand and through your body and through your leg how to get them to engage their hind end, because naturally they're not going to sit there. It's just like if you go to the gym, right? If you go to the gym and you're just allowed to lift the lightest weights possible, you're going to just lift the lightest weights possible, right? You're going to do the easiest way to do the least amount to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But once someone teaches you how to use your body and how to work in the gym and how to use your core properly, then you do it. It's the same with the horses. You have to get on them, and as a rider, you're not just a passenger. You have to use your hands and your legs and your body all together to teach that horse and give them instructions how to use their body.
At what age do you start teaching them to do that?
Right away. I mean, basically, as soon as they start the braking process, you start teaching them how to use their body.
Wow. Wow. Can that be a complicated process or a difficult process when you're working with a young horse, or do they usually pick up on it pretty quickly?
I mean, it's definitely from horse to horse. I think it's way easier when you're teaching a young horse, right? Like when you're teaching one that's never been broken and you're going to break it and you're going to teach it from the ground up. It's definitely easier to take one of those and teach them the proper instructions, how to use themselves behind. Whereas it's more challenging when you get one in that maybe someone else broke, or it's been at the racetrack for X amount of time and it's got some bad habits. Then you have to get that horse back and retrain it to use their body properly and go forward from there.
Well, believe it or not, we are halfway home in this edition of Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Coming up on this commercial break, I will continue my conversation with Michelle Hemingway when I return. Stay with me. This is indeed Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nominations are still open for the Phasic Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. Last year, the sale produced the 8 highest-priced fillies and mares sold at any U.S. breeding stock sale, led by Monomoy Girl, selling for $9.5 million. 22 horses sold for $1 million or higher, and the sale also produced the co-highest-priced weanling sold in the U.S. last year. Nominate your best today to the Phasic Tipton November Sale, a night of stars, Tuesday, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you sell?
Join the Maryland Jockey Club for the 36th running of Jim McKay Maryland Million Day. Saturday, October 23rd at Laurel Park. Come with friends and family to Maryland's Day at the Races. Enjoy a full day of racing with on-track entertainment between races. It will be fun for all at Laurel Park. Saturday, October 23rd. First post, 11:30 a.m. The 36th running of Jim McKay Maryland Million Day.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
As they run to the top of the stretch, there's a quarter of a mile remaining. Financial System is still the target. Longshot Manor House tries to gain ground second. Fuego Caliente third. The rest not in shouting range with 3/16 to go. Financial System 2.5. Manor House, Mirage trying to get another gear from him as he is making a bit of ground on this big favorite. Final 16th of a mile. Manor House is surging, and Manor House is going to make this close. Manor House is in time. Manor House ran down Financial System, beat him right on the money in 1:36 flat.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday afternoon, visiting with trainer Michelle Hemingway, who saddled her very first horse in the United States. And as you just heard from announcer Pete Aiello at Gulfstream, it was a victorious one when Manor House got the victory in the allowance optional claimer this past Saturday down in South Florida. And boy, what a moment it was for her. She was emotional, and she should be. You've heard part of her story in the first half of the program. I will continue this visit right after I remind you that if you did miss any portion of the show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this program and all of our shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net, and, of course, Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, Michelle, that call from Pete Aiello had to bring back a few memories, even though it was only a few days old, huh?
Yeah, I still get tears in my eyes when I hear it.
Yeah, very special moment. Would you say, we talked about it now working with Thorough Stock, which is a 40-acre training and rehab and breaking facility in Ocala, and Manor House, that's where he was. Would you say that Manor House is maybe one of the bigger success stories so far at Thorough Stock, or have there been others?
I mean, you know, there's been quite a few. One I'll mention is Bella Sophia, who's heading into the Filly and Mare Sprint.
She's pretty good.
Yeah, she's pretty good. She's a Thorough Stock success story. You know, she was bought by Saluzzo and Albina as a two-year-old. She came back here to Thorough Stock to sort of get her health, herself straightened about, and then the rest is history, right? I mean, she has to run down Gamine, but if anybody can do it, I think she can. You know, that's definitely a Thorough Stock success story right there in and of itself.
How closely do you follow those horses that come through the program when they leave you and they go to other trainers and they go on with the rest of their careers? How closely will you and the team stay in touch with them and follow them?
Extremely closely.
Yeah.
Extremely closely. We're in contact at least once a week, if not more.
No kidding. That much?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's a feather in the cap of everybody at Thorough Stock when a horse goes on to become like a Bella Sophia, or we talked about Manor House and that big win. It's a feather in the cap of the entire team. Talk to me a little bit more about the team that's involved at Thorough Stocks. It's certainly not just you or Nick. There's other people that help out.
Absolutely. So basically the way we work, and I want to just mention that between the team here at Thorough Stocks, we actually have three horses heading to the Breeders' Cup between our team here.
Wow. That's
so
huge.
At Thorough Stock, obviously, we have Nick Saluzzo, who I told you about. Then we have our director of business operations, who keeps everything flowing so that we can operate like a very corporate business, so we understand all the ins and outs and everything that's going on, and that's Vincent Graffio. He comes from a real technological background and is able to use his technology and his passion and his love for horses to put a system together for us. Then we have Jimmy Randolph, who is our director of training operations here with me, and he's just a super fantastic horseman. He and I work very well together. We have a great communication. And then we have our barn foreman, which is Luis Denise, and he does a wonderful job keeping everything inside the barn running. We have our farriers. We have a team of what we feel is world-class farriers to put things together, because really all the beginnings of a horse starts at the feet. If you can't have a foot, you're not going to have a horse. We have a team of veterinarians that we feel are also world-class, and without all of these integral parts, this place couldn't run like it does.
Yeah, it takes a village. There's no doubt about it. Is the plan for you, Michelle, now to continue to saddle horses that are maybe go through that Thorough Stock program and are trained on the Thorough Stock facilities? Is that your plan going forward?
Yeah, I think that is part of our plan going forward, that, you know, the horses that we want to have right here with us under our control will be moving forward and doing that with. Each horse will tell us what they need, and we'll go the direction that the horse needs.
So how does a girl that comes from the show horse world become so involved with thoroughbreds and eventually find herself working in South Africa? I think that's fascinating.
Well, like I said, I always rode show horses, but I always galloped race horses for my father in the morning before I went to school because my dad was a thoroughbred trainer. So I always sort of had to wear both hats. And when I was lucky enough, when I was riding the show horses, that my aunt took me to Mexico and Canada to compete on the show jumpers. And then my father, as a racehorse trainer, had been in Canada, England, Iran, actually. He trained for the Shah of Iran. And I just knew when I was coming out of university, I wanted to get a job in horse racing where my family had never been. And an opportunity was presented to me in South Africa through a breeding farm there, which was called Farsfontein. And across from them was a trainer called Glenn Cotson, and he hired me as an assistant out of college.
Do you remember when you must have been excited to make the trip over there, but were there some nerves involved too as you were making that move?
I mean, yes, but I had the experience through college to travel back and forth each year and get to know people there. It was definitely a different feeling the day that I walked into Dulles Airport to say goodbye to my dad, and I was getting on the plane and say goodbye to my mom, and I was getting on the plane, and I was like, okay, I'm going to South Africa again, but this time I don't know when I'm coming back. That was definitely a nervous feeling, but also an exciting feeling. It was time to, you know, stand on my own two feet and figure it out.
You know, I have to tell you, you just hit me up with something else that I wasn't aware of. You said that your dad trained for the Shah of Iran. I didn't even know that there was horse racing in Iran.
Yeah, in the 70s, when the Shah was in power, he used to have a place called the Imperial Palace. And my aunt was living over there with her husband, who was working for Reynolds Aluminum, and she was riding show jumpers at the Imperial Palace. And they used to have a large Arabian race every year that was the most prestigious race they had in Iran. And the Shah said to my aunt, I need someone who can train my Arabians to get ready for this race. And she said, well, my brother does that. And so they flew my father over to Iran, and he trained his Arabs for 2 years to run in this race, and he won it. So it was quite an experience. My aunt still loves Iran very much. She's written, I think, 4 books to date about her time in Iran.
Wow. You know, I mentioned, Michelle, at the very beginning of the program in my introduction that your background in racing is as extensive as anybody in the sport. And certainly from our conversation here so far, people are getting to know that. Visiting with Michelle Hemingway here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, let's talk a little bit more about your time then in South Africa. Tell me a little bit more about getting started over there and some of the things you experienced when you got to South Africa.
Well, Glenn was great. He owned a beautiful farm. We had 120 head in training at the lowest time. He was where I started, and his farm was about an hour outside of Cape Town. And they have racing 7 days a week in South Africa, just in a different area of the country each day. And it was interesting to learn to get over there and see how different the training techniques are over there versus what they are here. I was with Glenn for my first couple of years there, and then I got offered a job with Joey Ramsden, who is actually a native of England, and he was training right down in Cape Town at a training center called Milnerton. I ended up going on and taking the job with Joey because I was offered my own yard. So the way it works there is they have sort of the way we have here on the East Coast, for example, the prestigious meet in the summertime is Saratoga, and the prestigious meet in the wintertime is Gulfstream.
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, they have it. The prestigious meet in the summertime is Cape Town. The prestigious meet in the wintertime is Durban. They're across the country from each other. So going to work for Joey, the first 6 months, I worked for him in Cape Town, and then the second 6 months, I worked for him running his entire yard in Durban. So I was in charge of his yard, which is actually how I got involved with Michael de Kock, because he and Joey were best friends. So any time that Michael was in Dubai, we had his horses with Joey. So I was essentially able to manage a lot of Michael's horses through my involvement with Joey.
You mentioned that the training approaches are a bit different, and some of the things that are done there are different than we do here in the United States. What are some of the biggest differences, Michelle?
Well, for example, we at every yard, no matter what training center you're at, all the horses go out in three sets. So if you have 120 horses, do the math, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have 40 horses go out per set. But what happens is each groom has their own saddle, and they have to be able to at least post. So all 40 horses come out. They jog basically a half a mile in a jogging ring before they go out to the track, and then they ring, and you have a filly's ring and a colt's ring. And then you separate, and you put the work riders on, and you send them out to do their work in the morning. Every Monday in South Africa basically is just what we call a canter day. Tuesdays can be pace work, which is when you pair two horses together and teach them to sort of pull each other along. Wednesdays would be a jog day. Thursdays would be pace work. Fridays would be a grass gallop, which would be essentially like our breeze, or Saturdays, and we would vary their training like that. But not only that, not only is the pace different, other than basically one oval track in the whole country, almost every track is straight and either up and down a hill, and each track has a different surface. So one would be called the heavy sand, the beach track, the light sand, the cinders, and you would choose where you wanted your horse to train based on the depth of the racetrack you wanted them to be on.
Wow. Do you think that's a more effective approach than what we have here in the United States, or is it just simply different?
I wouldn't say it's more effective. I'd say it's just very different. I do think that, to be honest, I saw a lot less soft tissue injuries because you could change the depth in the horse's training based on their needs. So I did see a lot less soft tissue injuries in my time there than I did here.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Do you think that the horses in South Africa are, well, let me put it this way. I've always said that when you see a South African bred horse that's been racing in South Africa and they come here to the United States, they are tough as nails. And I've said that for many years. Do you find that they're tougher horses in South Africa than we have here?
They're definitely tough horses. I mean, one of the horses that I loved to gallop over there that was one of my grade one winners, and he was an excellent stayer, was a horse called Major Bluff. And he only retired when he was about 12. And he was just a lovely, lovely animal. So I think they definitely have a lot more fortitude about them. There's a lot of strength bred into the breed. But I think, you know, I'm hopeful that we're going to get back into that sort of direction here in the States.
Yeah, of course, because of the economics of the industry here in the States and the fact that, you know, horses after their three-year-old campaigns, if they're successful, are worth so much money. We see a lot of these horses go to stud, and we don't have a chance to see them as older horses. Is that different in South Africa too, Michelle, where horses will compete into their maybe 5, 6, 7-year-old years?
Oh, yeah, because they're a lot quicker to geld them over there. The colts, for sure. I mean, I'll be honest, they don't deal with as many problem behaviors over there as especially with the colts as we do here, based on, you know, breeding value or stallion value. If the horse, the way they think of it over there, okay, the horse can be the greatest horse in the world, but if it can't run based on pedigree, but if it can't run to its ability because of behavioral issues, then they're very quick to castrate them.
Yeah. You know, people may not be as familiar with Joey Ramsden and Glenn Coatson, who you mentioned, but they are familiar with Michael Decock. We've seen him here in the United States, and he's made a name for himself as one of the best international trainers based in South Africa. What is it about a person like Michael Decock that makes him such a good trainer?
He is a brilliant person. I mean, he has almost... My experience with him was, I feel he has almost a photographic memory. He can sit there and watch the horse train, and he'll tell you exactly what to do. He really understands horses. I mean, one of the ones that I got to work with him was a horse called Asiatic Boy. Mm-hmm. And he won the Derby in Dubai, and he was just a phenomenal horse. But he was a little bit of a challenging horse, and I got to see Mike and see the way, you know, he worked with that horse and what he taught him and how he dealt with him. And then another one was that filly Iridescence that was unfortunately got scratched in the Dubai World Cup day when she kicked, you know, the side of the rail and damaged her pedal bone, and it was a mess and he had to scratch her. You know, it was amazing to watch him and watch what he did. But I think for me, a filly that was very special that actually didn't have anything to do with Michael Decock, but did have something to do with Glenn Coatson, and now has some some ties here to the United States was when I first moved there, the first filly that I had the opportunity to oversee was a filly called Alexandra Rose. Mm-hmm. And we ended up selling her for quite a lot of money to Australia. And she is actually the dam of a filly that Team Valor owns called Alexandra.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sure most of these trainers will be familiar. Alexandra's become one of the better turf fillies in the country. And that Alexandra Rose was her mother. So it's nice to get to follow that and see it together. I know that, you know, with our connections here going into the Breeders' Cup between Bella Sophia, Mind Control for the Mile, and then my personal connection with Warlike Goddess for the turf, I've been really watching a lot of turf racing, and it was just neat to see Alexandra go forward and me having had Alexandra Rose and watch the family progress.
Is turf racing the main surface in South Africa, or do they have much dirt racing?
Actually, when I was there, all we had was turf racing.
Yeah.
Everything was turf racing, and what is also interesting about over there is a lot of different tracks run to the right, and then some of them run to the left. So it
wow.
just depends on which province you're in, if you're running to the left or if you're running to the right. And even sometimes within the same province, when I was training there in KwaZulu-Natal, you had Clarewood would run to the left, but Grayville would run to the right. So within the same province, you would go left or right sometimes. But, you know, it was definitely an experience.
How challenging can that be for a horse when they have to go left and then maybe take them to the next track and they have to go right?
I think over there it wasn't quite as challenging, especially not for the sprinters, because more or less if they're going 6 furlongs and even some tracks, if they were going 7 furlongs, it's just up a straight. You know, and really, even when they were going 2 turns, as long as the jockey's directing them, some horses had a harder time than others, and you would end up using a cheek piece to get a blinder to get them corrected. But for the most part, they pretty much get it.
You know, Michelle, I had the chance years ago when Gary Player was in town here at Keeneland.
So wonderful.
Yeah, he was in town for the Owner View Conference. It was the inaugural one at Keeneland, and he was the keynote speaker. And I had the opportunity to sit down with Gary for an interview in the Keeneland press box, one-on-one for 30 minutes. And it was one of the greatest things I've done in radio. He's such a special person, but he has a major operation. Yeah, he has a major operation in South Africa. Did you spent some time with him?
Oh, yes, I spent a lot of time with him. I was actually involved with selling a stallion to his place once I came back here to the States. You know, one of the major owners that I trained for was Graham Beck when I was with Joey Ramsden. Graham was one of our biggest clients over there, and I think my funniest story I ever had was about 3 months into working for Joey. He had a filly by St. Bellotto that Mr. Beck owned that he'd bred in the States, and she was a little bit of a head case. She was really, really tough to gallop. She wanted to run off every day. So I said to Joey, I said, let me ride her a little bit like a show horse for a few days and just kind of get her going differently. So I did that, and after about a month, I got her going and got her galloping and got her on the track. So we were finally ready to start her 1,200 meters, which is 6 furlongs up the straight. And Joey asked me, she was 8-1. He said, what do you think? I said, I think if she breaks clean and settles, she'll win. They won't catch her. So we walk in after I've saddled her up. We walk up to talk to Mr. Beck. Mr. Beck takes his cane. Joey goes to say something to him. Mr. Beck takes his cane, puts it across Joey and says, I don't want to hear from you. I want to hear from her. She rides her. And so I had that conversation with Mr. Beck, and, you know, it was kind of like a manor house day. She went on, and she won. She won by about 4. So it was really exciting, and I was able to develop a good relationship with Mr. and Mrs. Beck from that.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I'm sure you've met so many people along the way that have been special to you, whether personally or for your career. So when you think about your time and your travels, and I mentioned the well-rounded nature of your background in thoroughbred racing, Michelle, who are some of the other people when you think back on your career in the sport that you're always going to say, you know what, that's a person that helped me an awful lot?
Honestly, I know it's going to sound however it sounds, but, you know, Nick Saluso has been hugely instrumental in my career. I mean, even going back to before I came to work for him, when I was at the two-year-old sales and things like that, you know, a couple of years ago in 2019, when I had that filly Warlike Goddess in my consignment, Nick was looking at her and another one, and he was hugely instrumental in helping me along the way, and saying to me, you know, this is how you should do it. I like this horse. I don't like this one. Maybe change this. Maybe change that. He's really been a mentor and a huge inspiration to me. I was very lucky that Donato Lanny bought Warlike Goddess from me and has just really been supportive of me and my career after he's developed her. Glenn Popson, the first person to give me a job in South Africa, has been just, you know, amazing and supportive of my career. And I think, funny, it's not like he really did anything for my career, but he really made me really fall in love with it. When I was 9 years old, my dad used to sneak me onto the racetrack with him, right?
Yeah.
And he would sneak me onto the racetrack, and I loved gray horses, and I loved Mike Smith. Still do, to this day. Like, everybody knows, if Mike Smith, like, I will go anywhere to watch Mike Smith ride. And I was 9 years old, and it was when he had Holy Bull, and my dad was good friends with Miguel Gutierrez, who's now the lead outrider for Naira. And he was friends with Mike, and he was ponying Mike on Holy Bull, and he said, Miguel, do you think you can get my daughter to see Holy Bull and see Mike? And Miguel said, sure, Clark, I'll get it done. And he brought me out there, and I got to meet Mike, and I got to meet Holy Bull. And the way Miguel did it and the way it happened that day, I'll never forget it for my whole life. And I finally never saw Miguel again until about 2 years ago. And I saw him, and we've developed a great friendship. And I'm really appreciative of those stories and those things that make you remember why you love the game so much.
You have taken this conversation, Michelle, down a very personal path for me. Holy Bull, to this day, is still my all-time favorite racehorse. And because
mine
of
too.
That, I followed Mike Smith very closely, too, in his career. And now we've become, you know, very good friends through the radio program and everything. And it's amazing the journeys that this sport will take you on, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible. And, I mean, Holy Bull is still, like you, my favorite racehorse to this day. And I'm involved with a charity here in Florida called Run for the Ribbons, where we have a transformation expo from making, you know, thoroughbred racehorses, even thoroughbreds who couldn't make the races, and giving them a second career. And we're trying to get some people behind our program. And interestingly enough, our most popular sire, there's two of the sires that are most popular in remaking sport horses, and it's Holy Bull and Bodemeister.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, he was just such a special horse to me, and that was before I even arrived in Kentucky and got involved in the industry. I was just a fan at that point, and he was one of the horses that really drew me into the sport, and I'm so thankful that there were those types of horses that could do that for me and for you.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it looks like we're down to the final, well, it looks like about 4 minutes or so, Michelle, so I'll wind down the show this way. I always like to ask trainers to let me know something about them that maybe we haven't touched on yet. Maybe it's a little more personal, or something that you enjoy doing outside of racing, any other hobbies or things that you enjoy that aren't racing related. Is there anything like that in your life that you enjoy doing?
Well, I'm probably the biggest Disney fanatic you've ever met.
Really?
Yes. My group of friends and I, we all are Disney lovers. I have 5 small tattoos that are all Disney related, and we're annual pass holders, and we go to Disney down here as often as we can. And when I make it out to California for the Breeders' Cup, I'm going to do Disneyland one day, because, you know, Disney's my happy place other than horse racing.
Wow. Who's your favorite Disney character?
It's going to sound really funny, but there's actually a couple. And Elsa, I love Elsa from Frozen, but some people say I look like Elsa, so that sounds a little narcissistic, but that's not why. And actually, the little mouse from Cinderella, Gus Gus. I love Gus Gus. So those are my two favorites.
Wow. How about your favorite movie? Would those be your favorite movies?
No, all-time favorite movie is Sleeping Beauty.
Wow. Fantastic stuff. Michelle Hemingway here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. I told you she was well-rounded, and obviously a big fan of Disney and the characters, and it's her happy place when she's not at the racetrack. Her happy place last Saturday was at Gulfstream Park when Manor House crossed the finish line first, giving her first victory here in the U.S. And Michelle, I can tell you, I know, just listening to this conversation, you're going to have many more top moments ahead of you on the racetrack.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time and your interest.
Yeah, this has been fantastic. All the best moving forward, and keep up the great work. And you and Nick and the team down there, keep it rolling.
Thank you so much.
All right, Michelle Hemingway here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. What a fascinating conversation, huh? What an incredible hour. That's what this show is all about. I mean, she touched on so many things. And if you missed any portion of it, please go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check it out at your leisure. You will thoroughly enjoy this hour of Trainer Talk here tonight. But some of the things that she's learned along the way, and she has worked with some of the biggest names in the sport. When her time in South Africa, you heard her talk about her family's history and legacy in the sport, and they have left behind a legacy, both her grandfather and her father, her aunt. She talked about them. So she comes from a racing family. But now to be having this kind of success, and here she is, and she said people were asking her as she was walking over to the paddock to saddle last weekend at Gulfstream, to saddle Manor House. People were asking her, you know, why now? Why make the move now? Why do this? And as she said, the opportunity presented itself. And you kind of got the sense from hearing her story that that's what it's all about. That's what it's always been about for Michelle Hemingway. The opportunities presented themselves, and she took advantage of those opportunities. And now here she is, training horses on her own, continuing to have success. She's going to be successful with whatever she does. Wow, my thanks to Michelle Hemingway for taking time for that visit here tonight. Again, if you missed any portion, head to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios. Back next week with another brand new edition of Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. I'm Mike Pena. Thanks for listening.